Are you tired of the same boring and unhealthy diet of corporate media propaganda and the distraction du jour? Your antidote is here at Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Real, revolutionary, and relevant news and talk with fascinating and brilliant guests. Prepare to be informed and motivated with your friend and host, Cindy Sheehan.
Welcome back to the Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. This week, we welcome into our virtual Soapbox studio our engineer, Don DeBar. Don DeBar is not only the engineer for the Soapbox, but he is a political commentator, and he does the morning news on CPR Metro, and he makes many appearances on many different shows giving political commentary, but he's appeared a lot of times on Crosstalk on RT Russia Today. So stay tuned, and we'll be back with my friend and colleague, Don DeBar. Don DeBar, welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
My pleasure. How you doing, Cindy?
Good. You're on this side of the mic.
Yeah.
My listeners know you're my engineer, and you've helped us out when, I've needed a fill-in and things like that. So how are you doing, Don?
I'm making it. I'm kind of crashing after this election. I had mentioned on I think it was on Press TV when they asked me what I thought of the campaign. I said it reminded me of the Viagra commercial. For elections lasting more than 12 months, please call your physician.
Oh, my God, 12 months. If it were only 12 months, you know, geez. It was the interminable election season.
Yep. And all talk, no action. I mean, there was some policy discussion, not much. And most of that really coming from Trump, surprisingly, out of the two of them. Of course, from Jill Stein a lot. And the Gary Johnson Aleppo was. But, otherwise it was Hillary Clinton accusing Trump of being, I don't know, a dupe of the Kremlin and, this whole Cold War mentality coming out of them. And you're a racist and you're a crook and, you know, what meanwhile are you people going to do for us?
Right, exactly. So before we get into, well, I guess we are into it, but do you think this is the end of Hillary Clinton?
Well,
if anything positive is going to come out of this election.
Well, if that happens, that's something positive.
Yeah.
At least having that wing of the Democratic Party on the outs for a while would be great. Now, you know, that's what we thought happened after the primaries in 2008. And the next thing you know, you've got Rahm Emanuel as the chief of staff and Hillary Clinton as the secretary of state and a whole gaggle of those characters and some of the neocons back in the White House after people voted for change, they hoped.
Right.
So who knows this time?
So what do you think the Trump voters are looking at, a little more than a week since the election? What do you think that with the moves that Trump has made, do you think they're disappointed? Do you think that they're satisfied? Do you think that they're starting to get the same idea that many liberal Democrats had in 2008, especially with the, like you said, the appointments that were so horrendous?
I don't know yet. as you know, I went to both conventions, and one of the things that was most interesting to me was seeing what happened, on the ground in Cleveland and in Philadelphia, and then watching the TV show and the media report about what was happening in those places, and this huge vector between what I saw and what they were reporting in each case. And the relevant part, I think, is that in Cleveland, where we were expecting from the news reports to see both a perhaps a brokered convention and a big floor fight and,
right.
and big marches from the left shutting down Trump and you know, swastikas and stars and bars everywhere. We actually saw the Republican Party united around Trump. The people there, not there over any of that, you know, Republican nonsense that, that Trump used, like the rest of them have for years, massaging Islamophobia, anti-immigrant sentiment, racism, whatever. Rather, they're there because they need a job, and they heard him say he's going to get them a job. And one of the things that I spoke to a few hundred of them. I mean, you know, we were there 4 days. And every day, the way it was laid out, they're in the basketball stadium where the Cavaliers play. There's a big green in front of it, and then across the green is the baseball stadium where the Indians play. And on the, excuse me, on the green, they have like food court set up and then a stage, and they'd have events there when the convention let out. And so there'd be, you know, a couple thousand people, you know, milling in and out of this square over the course of the day a couple times. And I'd find a choke point somewhere and make a point of talking with somebody. And so I would say maybe 200-300 people over the course of 4 days. And the question I asked them was this: if Trump got knocked out somehow, if the, you know, shenanigans of the, you know, Republican elite pushed him out, and Sanders somehow comes out of the Democratic convention as the candidate, are you going to vote for the Republican or for Sanders? And out of all the people I spoke with, only one person didn't say Sanders, of course, because Sanders was also selling, in their mind, the same thing that Trump was selling: he's going to get me a job. Mm-hmm. If you stand in Cleveland, like if you're, you know, in Southern California, you've got the Pacific Ocean or the Pacific Palisades as a backdrop looming over you, you know, Hollywood Hills and LA, whatever, you know, the background, there's, that's kind of the landscape in the background. In Cleveland or here in New York, you got the Palisades on the Hudson River or whatever. In Cleveland, you've got empty factories.
Right.
So, you know, you had the whole left go there. And, you know, they were going to be leading these big parades or whatever. Nobody showed up but the organizers. The only protest that I even heard of was when this guy from the RCP was trying to provoke some Trump people by burning the flag, and he lit himself on fire.
Right.
Other than that, there was nothing. In Philadelphia, which you didn't hear, first of all, every day, half the delegates walked out, the Sanders people. And I mean, you know, you've got another basketball arena that's filled with thousands and thousands of people. Half of them get up and walk out. And when they go outside, there's people that are in the streets all around the site and in downtown Philadelphia, tens of thousands of them. That convention was not unified. It wasn't stronger together. There was a really strong anti-Clinton sentiment expressed by thousands of people that would walk out of there and chant, "Hey, hey, DNC, we won't vote for Hillary." I mean, the whole presentation in the media had nothing to do with what was going on in the ground. And so what the people that voted for Trump or that didn't vote for Clinton, that weren't scared into, "I got to go out and vote for her even though I don't like her,"
mm-hmm.
Most people were watching on television for 2 years almost how they had to do this, and yet they weren't motivated. So what they're watching now, to answer your question, that was the background to it, when they're seeing, oh, you know, it's Breitbart, he's a Nazi, and it's this one, he's a, you know, insider, and he's that one from Wall Street, I don't think they care about anything. They know if Trump can get past the soft coup, it seems they're preparing, they're trying to get the Electoral College to, you know, break with law and tradition and anoint Hillary. If they don't get past that, by the way, nobody's talking about it yet that I've heard, but early January, you have the joint session of Congress where they have to ratify the Electoral College decision. You know, the leadership of both parties opposed Trump, and really the problem with Trump is the foreign policy aspects, the trade agreements, you know, not wanting war with Russia and no regime change. Whatever he intends, that's what he promises, and that's what has those people scared. So you know, they're organizing this stuff now to try to make the country ungovernable, but I think they're going to try to keep him from taking office. That said, you know, January 20th, he takes office, and I think that's when these people that lifted him up are going to be expecting him to do something. And before that, I think that they're just going to hang in there. That's my guess.
Right. You know, Clinton did terribly in states that usually go blue, so-called Democrat, but those states were in the Rust Belt, and the so-called Rust Belt. And I read an article today that Clinton's campaign of, I forget what her campaign manager's name was, but, you know, the campaign chairman, Podesta, and the campaign manager, they practically shut Bill Clinton out. Whatever you think about Bill Clinton, which I don't think much about him, he has a very bright political mind. And I understand he was trying to talk the campaign into talking about jobs and the economy and what Clinton would do if she became president, but they decided that they were just going to focus on how terrible Trump was. And that, whatever else happened, WikiLeaks, the emails, the FBI, or misogyny, whatever else happened, that cost her the election.
Yeah, I think definitely. I mean, look, it was close. You know, she lost Pennsylvania, and the margin there, Tony Montero pointed out to me, is a 50,000 vote margin. Basically, folks in and primarily black districts that stayed home in Philadelphia. You know, forgetting everything else that happened throughout the state. You know, this particular out in Pittsburgh area, out in Western PA, where, you know, that is like, you know, firmly in that Rust Belt area, and most people probably weren't going to go for Clinton no matter what. But she lost it in Philadelphia, and the problem was exactly that. You know, they were trying to scare people into voting against Trump without offering people that are in desperate straits anything affirmative. Like, you, I promise you, I'm going to give you this, and maybe detailing it a little bit. And that's the kind of thing. And, you know, Bill Clinton went to Philly. And actually, he did not get well received there. But the advice that he supposedly was giving, that she needed to focus on Pennsylvania, Ohio, you know, Wisconsin,
Michigan,
you know, that whole area, that was correct. I don't know that she could have done anything there because you've got, you know, 20 years, 25 years worth of policy that a lot of them remember. But certainly, not going there wasn't the answer.
Well, she, I don't know if it was arrogance, you know, simple arrogance, and combined with her festering ambition that blinded her. And as you know, that the Democratic faithful in there, you know, the sycophants and everybody, they're just like blaming everybody except the horrible campaign decisions.
Yeah. And they were even blaming the voters. You know, they're blaming, you know, I heard, for example, there were women that voted for Trump. You know, they are using like Stockholm syndrome descriptions of those voters that, you know, they've internalized misogyny. Mm-hmm. Not these people are desperate and need a job. And, you know, they're used to having to go to somebody that they don't like for what they need, but there's nobody offering them a job but Trump in this configuration. And, you know, they're not giving any account to that. You know, the thing that really is, I think, the real context here is that there is an uprising of the working class that's generalized, that you saw Trump, the phenomenon of, you know, the white working class inside the Republican Party saying, you know what, we're not voting for a Bush anymore. We're not voting for how this candidate feels about abortion or about gay rights or any of that stuff. We don't care about that. Mm-hmm. I need a job. And so that's what happened there. The same thing in the Democratic Party with Sanders and in the streets as well. You know, it's useful to keep in mind that although, you know, we've had attention focus and protests in the streets over police killings of black people, that's been going on since there have been police and humans defined as black people in this country going back to the 17th century. I mean, they invented police to keep black people under control.
Right.
And there's uprisings. We've seen it at various times in the 19th century, early 20th century, in the 60s, you know, in the early 90s. But there's been a sustained effort now, and it's because, in addition to that, the conditions facing working people generally have become intolerable. And you've had a couple of developments take place over the past few years. Five years ago, last month, Occupy sweeps like wildfire. The main legacy of it is in the political narrative now is the concept of the 1% and the 99%, or more simply, class.
Right.
First time in the United States, maybe since the 30s, that people think in those terms in this country routinely. And then, since then, since 2007, 2008, the non-responsiveness of the entire establishment, the media fantasy, the economy's doing fine now, to a audience of millions of people who don't have a job, that are in foreclosure or whatever, the institutions have lost their legitimacy. People constantly are polled on everything, from the media to Congress to, all of it. They don't trust any of the institutions. So you have a situation where the entire working class, where they stand, they come to the party dressed the way they are. They come with a legacy of racism. They come with, a legacy of being betrayed by the union leadership. They come with the whole history of this country as legacy to the party with the clothes they wear, but they have class consciousness now. They have no confidence in their institutions, and their conditions are intolerable. To me, that's the mixture that spells revolution, and the problem is that the working class is not only divided, but it's being stoked to eat each of the factions. This segment of the working class is being told that segment of the working class is your enemy. They're a basket of deplorables. They're irretrievable. They can't be redeemed. They're nothing but hateful racists. Instead of, you need a job, you need a job, you need a job, they ain't giving it to you, let's go get them, which is what people need to be doing right now.
Right, I can't stand, I just really hate the liberals, for want of a better label to call them, attacking people in the white working class, and I don't even want to say white working class, just the working class, and it's like, that they're stupid and it's their fault, and they're using the rhetoric of the 1%. And I wrote in an article the other day or yesterday that, Trump and Clinton are members of the elite class, ruling class, whatever you want to call them.
Right.
And Trump, his campaign was able to capitalize on this dissatisfaction you talked about with Occupy Wall Street, with NAFTA, which, like you said, they haven't forgotten how all of their jobs went offshore during the Clinton administration, all of the jobs. And so Trump was able to capitalize on that fear of the future. People were fearful of the future, whereas, like we've already discussed, the elitist Clinton, people view her, and I see viewing Trump as a hero of the working class, to me, is the same as viewing Obama as the peace candidate. It's just what they're able to capitalize on with the voters. And so they see that Clinton is in the pocket of Wall Street. They see that she is in the pocket of the war machine. And this wasn't just a rejection of her. This was a rejection of 8 years of Obama.
Yeah, well, and in addition to that, not for nothing, this was featured across the media from, Fox, CNN, MSNBC, New York Times, Washington Post, even, Democracy Now and other, left media, Pacifica and stuff, that everyone was with her, which included, and they brought out each and every one of them, all of the Republicans that they were telling Democratic voters they had to vote for. Look, this Democrat's not so great, but that set of Republicans over there, so scary, got to vote against him. Now, suddenly, that whole group of people were with her, the Robert Kagan, all those people,
right,
with the whole group of them. This happened, and they were trumpeting it on television. Well, guess what? When you have a large number of people who, A, find their situation intolerable, and B, are seeing the people that brought them there on television saying that they're with Clinton, the last thing they're going to do is vote for her. You know, I think they were really tone deaf on that particular point.
The Clinton campaign?
Yeah. They were trumpeting the fact that they had the entire political elite on their side. In an election year, when the voters were rejecting the established political order.
Well, and this is one of the most extraordinary things of the Trump victory, or whatever you want to call it, last week. She did have all of the political institutions on her side. She had the media, she had the war machine, she had Wall Street, she had the neocons, as you, she had Bush, the Bush family on her side. It's like she had all these institutions on her side, and some, I don't think Trump won so much as she lost.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, not for nothing. You want to talk about a basket of deplorables.
Right.
You got Robert Reich and Robert Kagan and Victoria Nuland and Dick Cheney and, Madeleine Albright. She was featured at the Democratic convention.
Yeah.
That was an instance, again, half the people got up and walked out.
Freudian slip. Well, look at what happened at the DNC when the anti-war contingent of the Sanders campaign, which, again, looking at him as the peace candidate, it was didn't show very deep analysis of what, you know, of reality. But when they were chanting no more war, the Clinton delegates, they were already preconditioned to start chanting USA, USA. And so what do the people who are out in the streets today, Don, what do they want? What do they, you know, they are rejecting Trump, who, you know, I can look at his 100-day plan, and there's some things in his 100-day plan that would be in my 100-day plan if I were president. Yeah. And, you know, some of his rhetoric was horrible, but they don't want Trump. But what do they want?
Well, here's the thing. There's a couple of tells that are out there. First is that, you know, the size of, well, you and I both know a lot of people that do community organizing in, you know, New York City, Los Angeles, Bay, wherever, around D.C. And those are people, a lot of them are people that actually do community work 24/7.
You
know, the lawyers that are in landlord-tenant court, defending tenants all the time, protecting people from eviction, you know, and they're in the trenches, and they know more than, and I think they probably, because of their daily experience, put more weight in the nuanced differences to the extent they exist between Democrats and Republicans, because they know sometimes it means an extra $150,000 of funding for, you know, legal aid or something else that is woefully needed. But so those folks are out there over what Trump said and just generally looking at the response they would usually have. We have a Republican Congress and a Republican president. We got to start organizing. They're part of that. In addition to those folks, however, there's a massive organizing effort with groups like Move On, Change.org, that seems bent on trying to change the outcome of the election. You know, you had a petition that in 2 days at change.org calling on the Electoral College to reject Trump got 2 million signatures in 2 days. Now, whoever organized this, they weren't out there organizing a petition to get 2 million signatures to tell Obama do something about killer cops.
Right.
Or they weren't there to stop the war on Libya or Syria, or they're not there, by the way, while the Obama administration, either in control of or, you know, sort of at the mercy of the military, has deployed 300,000 troops to Russia's border, going weapons hot with the missile defense system there, and has essentially a military encirclement deployed to Russia and China from the Baltics to the Korean Peninsula, Wow, they're threatening World War III, basically. You don't get 2 million signatures for that either. So, however, keeping Trump out of the White House, they can get 2 million signatures in 2 days. So, aside from the actual organizers who are, you know, have bona fides that are out there doing what they always do, you've got added power of this particular operation that looks more to me like they're trying to do a soft coup. And, you know, I was talking with a friend of mine who's in Venezuela, and we were going through some of the details of that early today, and then another friend down in Nicaragua. And I said, you know, I'm reading this the way I'm seeing this. It looks like the kind of thing that they do in your country, in Brazil, you know, Argentina, et cetera, right before they make some big move. And they said, yeah, that's how we're seeing it, too. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the things that are going on in the street right now are riddled with contradiction. But I think the organized effort of it, the kernel of it, and the part that's linked to the media, that's linked also to the elite, I think is aimed at trying to keep Trump out of office. And, you know, he won the election by the rules that they have. So if he doesn't take office because of some machinations, you have, in effect, a coup d'etat.
Well, and you're looking at, you know, you look at Hillary Clinton, it's not like any of this stuff would have been a surprise to her or her campaign. It's right. Like she agreed to, she's running for office under the same, you know, establishment, empire, regime, whatever you want to say, that Donald Trump ran. So, right. Of course, if she had won, George Soros wouldn't have funded a petition to overturn the decision in the Electoral College, right?
That's right.
I don't know. Maybe Coke would have, but Soros wouldn't.
There's the, you know, it's difficult to call them giants, but there's the heavy hands that are behind the scene, and they arm wrestle with each other, and, you know, the rest of us are kind of pawns in their eyes, and sometimes in fact. But, you know, to me, the real tell in all of that is this. You of course, are familiar with UNAC. And I have a great deal of respect for that organization in many ways, for having pulled together what it could, absent our Democratic friends over the past 8 years, to try to maintain some sort of an anti-war presence in the United States. That said, their takeaway from this election is go in the streets and reject Trump, as opposed to what I think they should be doing is saying, okay, Trump was elected. He, for all the bad stuff he says, and we're going to fight that, he was our candidate saying, one, let's not have any more regime change, mm-hmm. no more nation building, no war with Russia and China, mm-hmm. and do we really need NATO? It wasn't mission accomplished back in 1991 for NATO. Now, not for nothing, he's the first major party presidential candidate to even introduce a counter-narrative to the bipartisan, you know, foreign policy consensus since Reagan. All right, that's 36 years. And he won. And so to me, what UNAC should be doing is saying, okay, Trump, you promised this stuff, we're holding your feet to the fire because we agree with it, and we got your back. When you go to Congress, if they all try to stop you from doing this and try to force you into war, we'll go in the streets. This stuff that you promised with walls and, you know, Islamophobia and all that, we oppose, and we'll be in the streets over that. And then having UNAC say directly to Trump voters, look, we saw you give him a standing ovation at the convention when he said no more regime change and no war. Okay, we're with you on that, and we will stand next to you to help you help him make that happen. We are the people that this other crap is directed at, and we're in the same boat as you. We want you to help defend us if they come after us. To me, that's the kind of work that should be done by groups like UNAC and the people that are our allies on the ground, the people we work with, not branding these people as, you know, the deplorables and saying we're gonna take Trump out, which means put Clinton in.
Right. I mean, I know. Right. Exactly. I just, it doesn't even make it. If you are under the letter of the law, the rule of the law. It doesn't make any sense in any of those categories. I mean, they're even starting to write articles of impeachment. I'm like, how in the hell can you write articles of impeachment for somebody who hasn't even been sworn in yet? You can't impeach somebody before he or she's president. You know, it's just like, and what about Obama and all his crimes against the Constitution and against humanity? And to me, the people that are out there saying we don't want Trump as president, they should be surrounding the White House saying, Obama, you have 2 months. Overturn some of your imperial presidential powers. Right. Start ending the war. Start putting Trump on a path that we want. What right now, if he comes in like the last several presidents have, like gangbusters, consolidating power into one branch of the government, then that's what these people deserve. Because they haven't been in the streets with us protesting Obama's persecution of whistleblowers, protesting Obama's deportation of more immigrant and undocumented workers than any of the presidents before him combined. They haven't been protesting the wars. They haven't been protesting his kill list. They haven't been protesting all of the domestic spying that occurred when Obama was president. If they have a Trump presidency that's like the Obama presidency, it's their own damn fault.
Right. Not only that, let's say that they don't have the belly to call for the impeachment of Obama for whatever reason. He's a Democrat, he's our first black president, whatever the, you know, reasoning or whatever the excuse is. They could still prosecute Bush, and they were all, you know, gangbusters for that till Obama said, no, we're going to look forward, not back, and now they're fine.
Right.
But with Trump, they're looking back and forward and every which way to whatever they can with him. You had this guy from the Times say, well, Trump should face one of two things, either impeachment or being blocked at the Electoral College. And then in an interview the following day, he says, oh, yeah, there's one other thing, of course. He could be assassinated. Okay, this is a reporter from the New York Times. I'm saying to myself, if I said that, the Secret Service would be knocking on my – no, they wouldn't be knocking. It would be a no-knock warrant.
They'd be breaking your door down.
No, they'd throw me in a room and then throw away the room.
Right.
but that's what's going on. People are, you know, are in that kind of hysteria. And, you know, it's one thing to say our institutions are illegitimate, like the Electoral College, which, you know, it's hard to make an argument defending it. But if you trash the rules in favor of a different outcome, if you see that the entire elite is in favor of doing that and they're pushing you to join them, you got to ask yourself some questions. Like, if we do away with the rules and the elite is in the driver's seat for that, what do we have left to defend us from them?
Well, I'm all for a revolution of the proletariat to overthrow capitalism, imperialism, whatever isms, but I'm not for a coup to take away one member of the elite and replace it with an even worse member of the so-called ruling class, you know? So if we want to overthrow the whole system and deal with those consequences, I'm all for that. But talking about.
We have to be ready. If you look at revolutions over history, it doesn't come out well if the working class or the class that's, you know, going to seize power isn't prepared to govern. And the working class right now is at each other's throats. These various sectors of it need to develop a common program. Everybody needs jobs, and everybody needs for these wars to end. And that's a consensus position. Last time, I'm going to refer back to the two conventions, but this is the thing that got me the most. You know, I'm standing on the floor of the Republican convention, and I'm against the wall with my back. I'm facing the audience the same way that the people on the stage are, and I'm like 9 people away from the stage against this wall. So I see the whole place, the whole assembled group of Republicans there. Trump says No more regime change, no more nation building, no war with Russia and China. And the whole group of them stand up and give him a wild standing ovation. Okay, then I'm at the, this is, you know, these are Republican district leaders, county and state legislators, you know, the apparatus of the Republican Party doing, you know, that's their center of gravity on these wars. We had no idea that that's how they felt. And then I'm at the Democratic convention, and, for example, Madeleine Albright comes out, or the General Allen, whatever the hell his name is, who's barking at the convention, and the Sanders people walk out in protest, and the Clinton supporters are USA, USA, USA. And they're spewing this Cold War rhetoric from the stage. Russia is the enemy. We got to deal with Putin. We're going to get tough with them. We're going to go in and kick Russia out of Syria and all this other stuff. And I'm saying to myself, no one's getting this at home. It's not being reported. But this is the break in our class. It's one of the, you know, fissure points in our class, and it's something that we have to come to terms with.
Well, and that's, you know, and that's the thing. It's not just the Democratic elite. You know, the, like you said, the people at the precinct leaders, the state leaders, the established Democrats who are ridiculing Trump because he wants to use diplomacy with, like, Russia, Syria, and China. They're ridiculing him for this. And it's just, to me, incomprehensible, except maybe they have to, because maybe in some subconscious way, because it's, I don't think it's really conscious, they know that they can't support Trump in that, because Clinton, the Clinton, Obama, Bush regimes have been so completely different from that.
That's right. Yeah, this is a counter narrative to the entire consensus on foreign policy. That, and again, it's the first time in 36 years that there's been one that's been articulated by one of the two, you know, duopoly candidates. And it has the elite scared to death. You wouldn't have seen such a convergence of their top Republicans and Democrats around Hillary Clinton unless, you know, their puppeteers were really nervous over that. And also just the conditions where you have this generalized, if divided, working class uprising. You can't underestimate how nervous that makes them. And they were really successful at keeping the people in the streets, Black Lives Matter, and you know, people that are, you know, the pipeline people, that maybe not so much keeping them separated, but a lot of these groups from the Sanders campaign. If they had joined, then that would have lifted Sanders. And what they did was split them. They kept them separated. And then they took Sanders down by whatever mechanism led him to, you know, do that embarrassing stuff at the convention. And then targeting them against the working class that's behind Trump, so that they have everybody kind of like in a three-way tussle instead of unity. Because if there is working class unity at this moment, we are in a situation of crisis, and it's only going to get worse. Working class unity means that the class is preparing to actually govern, and that's the last thing they want to see happen.
Exactly. And this is what, this is like my final question or my final observation, and get your observation on it. Now, Bernie Sanders never, well, he, I don't say never, he didn't go after Hillary Clinton. He didn't attack her. He attacked everything she stood for, right?
Yeah.
But he didn't really go after her. So when he capitulated at the convention, I mean, many of us knew he was going to do that anyway, because that's what he said he was going to do. It wasn't so dramatic, because he never really attacked. In fact, he always said what a good friend she was and how much he admired her and blah, blah, blah. But the thing is, the Obama administration and the Clinton administration called Trump everything on the book crazy. You know, we don't want his finger on the nuclear. We don't want him to have the nuclear codes. You know, he's insane. He's whatever. He's a racist. He's a sexist. He's whatever. And but then, As soon as, you know, the results are in, they're saying, well, we have to unite behind him for the sake of America. What does that do to people?
You know, I don't think the term cognitive dissonance does service to the actual, response that's generated in people watching this. But, you know, it's another nail in the structure of a rebellion against the institutions. You know, people are watching these institutions that we were raised to believe were, you know, democratic processes and democratically governed institutions that are responsive to our needs and that are going to provide a better way of life for us over generations and such. Nobody believes that anymore. And then the media performance over the last 18 months, you know, the media was polling in the single digits before then. You know, now, you know, I don't think they believe the weather reports anymore because, CNN was nothing but basically, here's footage of Trump. Well, we tell you what he said. They barely even play the whole pieces. They give you little snippets. And then they spend like 2 hours describing what he said and calling him a lunatic and a racist and a this and a that and everything else. That was, we don't have time for news anymore. We're busy telling you how horrible Trump is for 18 months straight. And people are watching this and yet he won. Okay. So that tells you about the way people are viewing the media and their other institutions and the other, centers of authority that they've been used to looking at for a long time. They rejected it.
And what you were just talking about, it brought up indirectly something in my mind, too, another liberal contradiction and hypocrisy. They're upset, you know, many liberals are upset about Donald Trump and, you know, him saying that he let, you know, you can grab women if you're famous and things like that. But these same liberals are slut-shaming his wife.
I know. Naked pictures.
They're so disgusting towards who's going to be our next first lady, where they say, oh, Michelle Obama had so much class, and Melania, whatever, how you say her name, Trump, you know, yeah. She was a nude model and whatever. But right. Michelle Obama went to bed with a war criminal every night.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, that matters to me. And you were talking about Sanders calling Hillary Clinton a friend, but, you know, he's calling a war criminal a friend. And he's calling somebody that helped deploy AFRICOM to recolonize Africa a friend. He's calling somebody that, was referring to millions of African-American youth in the country as, by really horrible names, victimizers and, some words that I prefer not to use. But mm-hmm. Now, for me, I could never call anyone like that a friend. And there's something else that got me, too. Not for nothing. I mean, I'm a guy, okay? I know a lot of guys. And you're sitting around with guys from time to time. I've heard that come out of a whole lot of guys' mouths, that they're not misogynist generally. That mostly they're talking nonsense. And So many people that were so indignant over this, I'm thinking to myself, wait a minute, remember that time we were at the bar like 2 years ago and those three women walked in with this short, tight dresses? What were you saying then? Mm-hmm. they got so holier than thou all of a sudden. You know, that stuff is repulsive and it's primitive and it's moronic and all that stuff. But guess what? It is a solid part of this culture. The culture itself is misogynist. And you can see, by the way, it eats women and men, by the way, that's its nature. So, you know, to focus on that as the thing instead of a symptom of the real thing is, you know, disingenuous at best.
Absolutely. Well, Don, tell us, how is Community Progressive Radio doing?
Well, today, actually, we're recording on the 16th of November. We started migrating to a new server. The service is a little wavy today, tomorrow. But by the weekend, we should be able to handle about 10 times as many listeners as we have, so people won't get kicked off. And also people with Galaxies and other non-iPhones will be able to listen to the live stream. So, you know, we're doing slowly but surely, we're building. We also have invested a little bit of money in trying to grow our audience, get some more radio stations to carry us, and the newscast that we do 5 days a week, CPR News. And I'm expecting that we're going to be making a pretty big splash in the early part of next year.
Well, great. I hope we all do. And so the website is cprmetro.org.
.org.
Well, Don DeBar, thank you so much for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox in this really informative discussion we had. And really, we do live in interesting times.
Yes, indeed. My pleasure to speak with you whenever, Cindy. Thank you very much. And thank you for everything that you've done and that you do.
Okay. Thanks, Don. Soapbox for this week. As always, I hope you were informed and inspired to further action. I'd like to thank Don DeBar for doing double duty and being my guest and my engineer this week. I'm Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to The Soapbox. Peace out for now.